the meds. You know what I mean? If he speaks of his home situation, you can undoubtedly make helpful suggestions. Can he talk frankly with you so long as he does not bear business tales or criticize his associates? With this kind of employee, such an attitude will command undying loyalty. The greatest enemy of us alcoholics are resentment, jealousy, envy, frustration, and fear. Wherever men are gathered together in business, there will be rivalries, and arriving out of these a certain amount of office politics. Sometimes we alcoholics have an idea that people are trying to pull us down. Often this is not so at all, but sometimes our drinking will be used politically. I usually don't tell my employers that I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. The places where I've been working, I don't trust their understanding of it to a point where they won't look down on it or look on it as a weakness. But there are certain people in my businesses that I let know. And usually those are the people where I could be helpful later on down the road. Like where I work now, they may know I'm an alcoholic. They don't know it from my mouth, but there's two people on campus where I work that know I'm an alcoholic. One of them is somebody that works there that's also in the program, and the other is the school psychologist. And we let her, my wife and I let her know early on that we were in Alcoholics Anonymous because she calls on us to get speakers for the school. We're able to take certain students to meetings. So it would be almost a crime not to tell her, but she's responsible enough to understand and to keep my anonymity. I'm certainly not going to tell my boss I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, if there's any hope for a promotion, that would go out the window with me saying that. You know what I mean? Because he's just not the type of person who would understand. Each case is different. Each employment environment is different. You just need to use common sense. And one of the things I kind of discourage is somebody getting sober and with 2 days sobriety running in and telling everybody that they're an Alcoholics Anonymous. That's almost like the person breaking their anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and film, and then going out and drinking. I mean, you break your anonymity in a work environment, and you go back out drinking, you make us look bad, you know? The hell with you. There'll be somebody going, oh yeah, so-and-so went to AA and for about 2 months, and he's drinking like a fish now. It must not work. You know what I mean? So you have to be conscious of that. Help us with anonymity in certain situations. Be considerate before you break your anonymity. One instance comes to mind in which a malicious individual was always making friendly little jokes about an alcoholic's drinking exploits. In this way, he was slyly carrying tales. In another case, an alcoholic was sent to a hospital for treatment. Only a few knew of it at first, but within a short time, it was billboarded throughout the entire company. Naturally, this sort of thing decreased the man's chance of recovery. The employer can many times protect the victim from this kind of a talk. The employer cannot play favorites, but he can always defend the man from needless provocation and unfair criticism. As a class, alcoholics are energetic people. They work hard and they play hard. Because we don't come in on Monday, we make up for it on Tuesday. You know, we're hard-working people. Your man should be on his mettle to make good. But somewhat weakened and faced with physical and mental readjustment to a life which knows no alcohol, he may overdo. You may have to curb his desire to work 16 hours a day. That's something that they didn't have to do with me, I'll tell you. You may need to encourage him to play once in a while. He may wish to do a lot for other alcoholics, and something of the sort may come up during business hours. A reasonable amount of latitude will be helpful. This work is necessary to maintain his sobriety. After your man has gone along without drinking for a few months, you may be able to make use of his services with other employees who are giving you the alcoholic runaround, provided, of course, they are willing to have a third party in the picture. An alcoholic who has recovered but holds a relatively unimportant job can talk to a man with a better position. Being on a radically different basis of life, he will never take advantage of the situation. Your man may be trusted. Long experience with alcoholic excuses naturally arouse suspicion. When his wife next calls saying he is sick, you might jump to the conclusion that he is drunk. If he is and is still trying to recover, he will tell you about it, even if it means the loss of his job. For he knows he must be honest if he would live at all. What a great line that is. He will appreciate knowing you are not bothering your head about him that you are not suspicious, nor are you trying to run his life so he will be shielded from temptation to drink. If he is conscientiously following the program of recovery, he can go anywhere your business may call him. Again, they talked about this in the chapter Working with Others. If you've got a reasonable amount of time in recovery and you still have problems with business meetings and restaurants where they serve liquor, or going to cocktail parties where you have a valid reason to be there, if you still have problems with that, you've got a for shit program, and that's just the way it is. There's something that you're just not working on. Now, every once in a while, we can get a little uneasy in a drinking situation, and we know enough to get out of there. But if you're the type of person who just can't be anywhere near it, or you start to freak out, you got a hole in your program, and you need to find it and work on it. In case he does stumble, even once, you will have to decide whether to let him go. If you are sure he doesn't mean business, there is no doubt you should discharge him. If, on the contrary, you are sure he is doing his utmost, you may wish to give him another chance. But you should feel under no obligation to keep him on, for your obligation has been well just discharged already. There is another thing you might wish to do. If your organization is a large one, your junior executives might be provided with this book. You might let them know you have no quarrel with the alcoholic of your organization. These juniors are often in a difficult position. Men under them are frequently their friends. So for one reason or another, they cover these men, hoping matters will take a turn for the better. They often jeopardize their own positions by trying to help serious drinkers who should have been fired long ago, or else given an opportunity to get well. Today we have departments in larger companies, human resources, and for the most part, these people are well versed in what type of actions they should take to send somebody to get help. After reading this book, a junior executive can go to such a man and say approximately this: "Look here, Ed, do you want to stop drinking or not? You put me on the spot every time you get drunk. It isn't fair to me or the firm. I have been learning something about alcoholism. If you are an alcoholic, you are a mighty sick man. You act like one. The firm wants to help you get over it. If you are interested, there is a way out. If you take it, your past will be forgotten, and the fact that you went away for treatment will not be mentioned. But if you cannot or will not stop drinking, I think you ought to resign." That's a good way to put it. Your junior executive may not agree with the contents of our book. He need not and often should not show it to his alcoholic prospect, but at least he will understand the problem and will no longer be misled by ordinary promises. He will be able to take a position with such a man which is eminently fair and square. He will have no further reason for covering up an alcoholic employee. It boils right down to this. No man should be fired just because he is alcoholic. I think it's even illegal now, because they recognize it as a disease. Weird things. If they catch you drinking, they can fire you. But if you're drunk, they can't fire you. Like, crazy things like that. But, I mean, I don't know from personal experience, because I've always worked for places. If they want to fire you, they're firing you, goddammit, you know? But I've heard of a lot of stories about, especially Postal Steve. He told me you can just be as drunk as a goat, but if they catch you with a bottle in the truck, that's different. You can be fired. But you can be drunk out of your mind doing rounds. You know, it's like it's tied up with the law. I always wondered why I got everybody else's mail but mine. If he wants to stop, he should be afforded a real chance. If he cannot or does not want to stop, he should be discharged. The exceptions are few. We think this method of approach will accomplish several things. It will permit the rehabilitation of good men. At the same time, you will feel no reluctance to rid yourselves of those who cannot or will not stop. Alcoholism may be causing your organization considerable damage in its waste of time, men, and reputation. We hope our suggestions will help you plug up this sometimes serious leak. We think we are sensitive when we urge that you stop this waste and give your worthwhile man a chance. They used to do this too with their 12-step prospects. If you didn't have an honest desire to stop drinking, the hell with you. They'd ostracize you back in the early days, you know. I mean, you really had to have a desire to stop drinking. Today, it's okay and fine to just walk into an AA meeting and sit in the back for years and years and years and stay miserable. But they wouldn't let you do that in the old days. If you weren't willing to go through the steps, they didn't want you in their meetings, you know. That's just the way it was. The other day, an approach was made to the vice president of a large industrial concern. He remarked, "I'm mighty glad you fellows got over your drinking, but the policy of this company is not to interfere with the habits of our employees. If a man drinks so much that his job suffers, we fire him. I don't see how you can be of any help to us, for as you see, we don't have any alcoholic problems. This same company spends millions for research every year. Their cost of production is figured to a fine decimal point. They have recreational facilities, there's company insurance, there is a real interest, both humanitarian and business, in the well-being of employees. But alcoholism, well, they just don't believe they have it. Perhaps this is a typical attitude. We who have collectively seen a great deal of business life, at least from the alcoholic angle, had to smile at this gentleman's sincere opinion. He might be shocked if he knew how much alcoholism is costing his organization a year. That company may harbor many actual or potential alcoholics. We believe the managers of large enterprises often have little idea how prevalent the problem is. Even if you feel your organization has no alcoholic problem, it might pay to take another look down the line. You may make some interesting discoveries. Of course, this chapter refers to alcoholics, sick people, deranged men. What our friend the vice president had in mind was in the habitual or whoopee drinker. As to them, his policy is undoubtedly sound, but he did not distinguish between such people and the alcoholic. It is not to be expected that an alcoholic employee will receive a disproportionate amount of time and attention. He should not be made a favorite. The right kind of man, the kind who recovers, will not want this sort of thing. He will not impose. Far from it, he will work like the devil and thank you to his dying day. Today I own a little company. There are two alcoholic employees who produce as much as five normal salesmen. But why not? They have a new attitude and they have been saved from a living death. I have enjoyed every moment spent in getting them straightened out. Tonight I'm going to start on page 151, chapter 11, A Vision for You. For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good, but not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control will enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. What took place in my drinking experience was there was a period of time when alcohol did for me what I could not do for myself. Alcohol set me free, and it was the absolute wonder tool. It brought me of age. You know what I mean? From the time I was about 16, I was a heavy drinker, till the time I was about 19. Alcohol, I mean, there was a lot of problems. There was, I crashed many cars, got many DWIs, embarrassed myself many times. But they were a small price to pay for how alcohol set me free. Alcohol was the great fear antidote for, it was the anti-Chris medication, you know what I mean? And I could go to a party and I could be larger than life. And after I was 20, it wasn't working like that anymore. It was just causing a lot of problems. And very rarely would I get that sense of ease and comfort that I got in the early days. Yet I chased after it like a demon. Even to the last days of my drinking, when I cracked the cap of that bottle, I really thought that somehow, some way, I could regain some of that peace and contentment that alcohol brought me in the early days. But it was elusive. I never could recapture it. But it was an obsession. It was an obsession in my mind to try to do so. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself, as we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that his loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. I used to go to the cafe in Morristown, down by the train station. If anybody ever drank there, that's a sordid place. Momentarily we did. Then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the four hideous horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. Now and then, a serious drinker being dry at the moment says, I don't miss it at all, feel better, work better, having a better time. As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such a sally. That's like the person who comes into AA, is sober about a week, and says, you know, everything's great. I don't need your steps. I don't need to make coffee. My life is just wonderful. We smile at such a sally. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself. Inwardly, he would give anything to take half a dozen drinks and get away with them. You meet these people in the beginners meeting over in Burnsville. He will presently try the old... He will presently try the old game again, for he isn't happy about his sobriety. He cannot picture life without alcohol. Someday he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness such as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. I have been at that jumping off place, and I have wished for the end, and it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me, because it established to the core of my being my first step understanding. We have shown how we got out from under. You say, yes, I'm willing, but am I to be consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring, and glum like some righteous people I see? I know I must get along without liquor, but how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute? Yes, there is a substitute, and it's vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. And I certainly relate to this too. My whole thought was, the last place in the world I was going to come is Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the home of the lame. You know what I mean? Like, why don't you just shoot me and put me out of my misery? I'm going to have to sit in church basements the rest of my life and talk about God. Just kill me and get it over with. You know, it would be a merciful death. And that's really how I thought. And for the first couple of months in AA, it was like taking a bitter pill. It was like swallowing castor oil to go to meetings. But I'll tell you once I started to bring to, the whole thing changed. And I'll tell you what, a meeting really is the highlight of my day now. I've got a great group of meetings that I go to. I love every one of them. I look forward to the people I see there. I love observing the insane drama of all my sponsees, you know, what they're getting in trouble with today. It's interesting, and I love it. It gives meaning to my life. How's that to come about, you ask? Where am I to find these people? Remember, this book was written to be sent out upon the tides of alcoholism throughout the country and the world, and there were only two meetings at the time of the printing of this book. So he's expecting people in Peoria to read this and not know what the hell he's talking about. So here's an explanation. You are going to meet these new friends in your own community. These are instructions. Near you, alcoholics are dying helplessly like people in a sinking ship. If you live in a large place, there are hundreds, high and low, rich and poor. These are future fellows of Alcoholics Anonymous. Among them, you will make lifelong friends. You will be bound to them with new and wonderful ties, for you will escape disaster together, and you will commence shoulder to shoulder your common journey. What a great group of promises we've read on the last page. I mean, forget about it. Then you will know what it means to give of yourself that others may survive and rediscover life. You will learn the full meaning of love thy neighbor as thyself. It may seem incredible that these men are to become happy, respected, and useful once more. How can they rise out of such misery, bad repute, and hopelessness? The practical answer is that since these things have happened among us, they can happen with you. Should you wish them above all else and be willing to make use of our experience, we are sure they will come. The age of miracles is still with us. Our own recovery proves that. And how could he be sure? Faith. That's how he could be sure. Because there was only two groups. And Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson were really the leaders of those groups. They started them. So how could they really know that this would happen on a wholesale scale across the board and there would be 4 million alcoholics in recovery in 1999? You know, they didn't, but they certainly had faith that it would happen. Our hope is that when this chip of a book is launched on the world tide of alcoholism, defeated drinkers will seize upon it to follow its suggestions. Many, we are sure, will rise to their feet and march on. They will approach still other sick ones, and fellowships of Alcoholics Anonymous may spring up in each city and hamlet, havens for those who must find a way out. This is the vision Bill Wilson had on his hospital bed during his last detox. He came to the conclusion that alcoholics could help other alcoholics. And thank God that he did, because look what we have today. I know my ass has been saved by it. In the chapter Working with Others, you gathered an idea of how we approach and aid others to help. Suppose now that through you, several families have adopted this way of life. You will want to know more of how to proceed from that point. Perhaps the best way of treating you to a glimpse of your future will be to describe the growth of the fellowship among us. Here's a brief account. Years ago, in 35, one of our number made a journey to a certain western city. That would be Akron. From a business standpoint, his trip came off badly. If he had been successful in his enterprise, he would have been set on his feet financially, which at the time seemed vitally important. But his venture wound up in a lawsuit and bogged down completely. The proceeding was shot through with much hard feeling and controversy. Bitterly discouraged, he found himself in a strange place, discredited and almost broke. Still physically weak and sober but a few months, he saw that his predicament was dangerous. He wanted so much to talk with someone, but whom? On a dismal afternoon, he paced a hotel lobby. And this is the Mayflower Hotel Bill Wilson story, if anyone doesn't recognize it. Wondering how his bill was to be paid. The poor guy didn't even have money to pay for his hotel room. Yeah, poor guy. At one end of the room stood a glass-covered directory of local churches. Down the lobby, a door opened into an attractive bar. He could see the gay crowd inside. In there, he would find companionship and release. Unless he took some drinks, he might not have the courage to scrape up an acquaintance and would have a lonely weekend. You know, that's how we think. Well, I'm going to have to take a drink, or else I'll never be able to ask what's your name on a date. Or I'm going to have to take a drink, or I'll never be able to deal with these people. Of course, he couldn't drink, but why not sit hopefully at a table, a bottle of ginger ale before him? After all, had he not been sober six months now? Perhaps he could handle, say, three drinks, no more. Fear gripped him. He was on thin ice. Again, it was the old insidious insanity, that first drink. With a shiver, he turned away and walked down to the lobby to the church directory. Music and gay chatter still floated to him from the bar. But what about his responsibilities, his family, and the men who would die because they would not know how to get well? Ah, yes, those other alcoholics. There must be many such in this town. He would phone a clergyman, his sanity returned, and he thanked God. Selecting a church at random from the directory, he stepped into the booth and lifted the receiver. His call to a clergyman led him presently to a certain resident of the town who, though formerly able and respected, was then nearing the nadir of alcoholic despair. And of course, that was Dr. Bob. What they don't tell you in this, though, was he had a certain number of nickels in his hand. And that really was all the money this guy had left. And what he did was he placed a bunch of calls. And a lot of the people he talked to, how he approached it was, I'm a rummy from New York and I need to talk to another rummy or else I'm going to drink. And most of the time, all he heard was the dial tone after he said that. But he got a hold of this one guy, Walter Tunks, who put him in touch with a number of people from the Osher group. And one of them was Henrietta Seiberling, and she was the person that he finally called, and she understood because she'd been going to Oxford group meetings with Ann and Bob Smith, hoping against hope for a divine miracle to allow Bob Smith to get sober, Dr. Bob to get sober. So in her mind, she said, this must be from God. This must be a message from God. I'm going to hook this guy up with Dr. Bob, and that's what happened. It was the usual situation, home in jeopardy, wife ill, children distracted, bills in arrears, and standing damaged. He had a desperate desire to stop but saw no way out, for he had earnestly tried many avenues of escape. Painfully aware of being somehow abnormal, the man did not fully realize what it meant to be alcoholic. When our friend related his experience, the man agreed that no amount of willpower he might muster could stop his drinking for long. A spiritual experience, he conceded, was absolutely necessary, but the price seemed high upon the basis suggested. He told how he lived in constant worry about those who might find out about his alcoholism. He had, of course, the familiar alcoholic obsession that few knew of his drinking. Why, he argued, should he lose the remainder of his business only to bring still more suffering to his family by foolishly admitting his plight to people from whom he made his livelihood? He would do anything, he said, but that. Dr. Bob was a proctologist. And it was already a joke at the hospital that if you went to Dr. Bob, you were betting your ass. Because you never knew how he was going to be when he was cutting on that puppy. You know what I mean? So he had already been down to probably one operation a month was all he was getting anyway. And he thought nobody knew about his drinking. Being intrigued, however, he invited our friend to his home. Sometime later, and just as he thought he was getting control of his liquor situation, he went on a roaring bender. For him, this was the spree that ended all sprees. He saw that he would have to face his problems squarely, that God might give him mastery. In other words, there were certain aspects to the Oxford group form of spiritual awakening exercises. Basically, what it was there were exercises to give your will and your life over to Jesus Christ. And this is what they were doing in the Oxford group. And Dr. Bob was unwilling to go make amends. He was unwilling to knock on the doors of the people he had wronged or harmed through his behavior. He thought that I'll make coffee, I'll go to 90 and 90, but I ain't making amends, okay? And this is what Dr. Bob was saying. And what happened was an Atlantic City convention came up, and he decided that this is for my career, you know. I have to go. I have to go to Europe on a wine tasting expedition, you know, with 30 days. You know, I have to do that for my family. You know, that's the way we think. You know, it's important. I'm an important guy. So off he went to Atlantic City, and the oral history is he didn't even make it to Atlantic City. He made it to the bar car in the train, and they had to like shovel him off somewhere. And he was so drunk. But anyway, here's what Dr. Bob did. Here's the last action he had to take to complete his house clean. One morning he took the bull by the horns and set out to tell those he feared what his trouble had been. He found himself surprisingly well received and learned that many knew of his drinking. Stepping into his car, he made the rounds of people he had hurt. He trembled as he went about, for this might mean ruin, particularly to a person in his line of business. At midnight he came home exhausted but very happy. He really never did a hell of a lot of butt operations in recovery. I mean, there's not a lot of evidence to show that his practice of butt operations in recovery. I mean, there's not a lot of evidence to show that his practice rebuilt itself. As a matter of fact, quite the opposite. He had to get money from AA to pay for the mortgage on his house. Because like Bill Wilson, he really started to dedicate his life to Alcoholics Anonymous and helping other alcoholics. And he never really did regain any kind of decent livelihood. Neither really did Bill Wilson. He has not had a drink since. As we shall see, he now means a great deal to his community, and the major liabilities of 30 years of hard drinking have been repaired in four. But life was not easy for the two friends. Plenty of difficulties presented themselves. Both saw that they must keep spiritually active. One day they called up the head nurse of a local hospital. They explained their need and inquired if she had a first-class alcoholic prospect. Yes, she replied. Yes, we've got a corker. He's just beaten up a couple of nurses. This is Bill Dotson. He goes off his head completely when he's drinking, but he's a grand chap when he's sober, though he's been here 8 times in the last 6 months. Understand, he was once a well-known lawyer in town, but just now we've got him strapped down tight. He was a prospect, all right. By the description, none too promising. The use of spiritual principles in such cases was not so well understood as it is now. But one of the friends said, put him in a private room and we'll be down. Now, this scared the hell out of the guy, okay, because back then in this Akron hospital, you never got a private room unless you were dying. If you were going to die, they put you in a private room so you could have a little bit of peace while you checked out. So this guy thought he was dying when they put him in the private room. 2 days later, a future fellow of Alcoholics Anonymous stared glassily at the strangers beside his bed. Who are you fellows and why this private room? I was always in a ward before. Said one of the visitors, we're giving you a treatment for alcoholism. Hopelessness was written large on the man's face as he replied, oh, but that's no use. Nothing would fix me. I'm a goner. The last 3 times I got drunk on the way home from here. I'm afraid to go out the door. I can't understand it. How many times have we seen people get drunk on the way home from detox? I mean, it just happened last Friday night. Mary Beth and some people took someone into a detox, and they were drunk within 12 hours of being released from the detox. I mean, that's, you know, when this kind of stuff happens. For an hour, the two friends told him about their drinking experiences. Over and over, he would say, that's me, I drink like that. The man in bed was told of the acute poisoning from which he suffered, how it deteriorates the body of the alcoholic and warps his mind. We know more about this now, about how it deteriorates the body, the pancreas and the liver. how it breaks down our ability to metabolize alcoholism, and how once we're at a certain point in alcoholic drinking, there is no turning back. There's no regaining the control you had in high school. It's never going to happen. And the mind, I mean, we all know what happens about that. Some people, when they go back out, in a very short period of time, a lot of shit happens, you know what I mean? And a lot of insanity comes back like pronto in high gear. And we also see that happen. There was much talk about the mental state preceding the first drink, like the obsession of the mind. Why do we pick up a drink when it's completely insane for us to do so? What type of logic do we use? "Yes, that's me," said the sick man, the very image. "You fellows know your stuff all right, but I don't see what good it'll do. You fellows are somebody. I was once, but I'm a nobody now. From what you tell me, I know more than ever I can't stop." At this, both of the visitors burst into laugh. Said the future fellow, "Anonymous, damn little to laugh about that I can see." The two friends spoke of their spiritual experience and told him about the course of action they had carried out. They talked about the steps, the 12 steps, as they were back in the Oxford group time, how they repaired the past, how they did the inventory, how they seek guidance, how they've turned their life over to God, etc., etc., etc. He interrupted, "I used to be strong for the church, but that won't fix it. I've prayed to God on hangover mornings and sworn that I'd never touch another drop, but by 9 o'clock I'd be boiled as an owl." Next day found the prospect more receptive. He had been thinking it over. "Maybe you're right," he said. "God ought to be able to do anything." Then he added, "He sure didn't do much for me when I was trying to fight this booze racket alone." On the third day, the lawyer gave his life to the care and direction of his Creator and said he was perfectly willing to do anything necessary. This is something Dr. Bob would make you do on your knees in front of whoever was there at the time. You would have to get down and turn your will and your life over to the care of God. This, you know what this did? This filtered out the bullshitters. You know what I mean? If you weren't willing to get sober, really willing, you weren't going to be doing that. His wife came, scarcely daring to be hopeful, though she thought she somehow saw something different about her husband already. He had begun to have a spiritual experience. That afternoon, he put on his clothes and walked from the hospital a free man. He entered a political campaign, making speeches, frequenting men's gatherings, places of all sorts, often staying up all night. He lost the race by only a narrow margin, but he had found God, and in finding God, he found himself. And it's a good thing he didn't didn't make any major changes in the first year, you know, because within a week he was running for mayor or something like that, and he almost won. He went on the alcoholic ticket. But the thing was, he had had a spiritual experience, okay? He had had a spiritual awakening, because back then they took you through the steps fast, hard, and thorough, and he was safe and protected from the first drink as long as he followed a few simple rules. That was in June 1935. He never drank again. He, too, has become a respected and useful member of his community. He has helped other men recover and is a power in the church from which he was long absent. So you see, there were three alcoholics in that town who now felt they had to give to others what they had found or be sunk. After several failures to find others, a fourth turned up. He came through an acquaintance who had heard the good news. He proved to be a devil-may-care young fellow whose parents could not make out whether he wanted to stop drinking or not. What the heck was this guy's name? This guy ended up marrying Dr. Bob's daughter. It was the first case of the... Ernie, you're right. It was the first case of the 13th step. Dr. Bob made a really big error. His daughter Sue was going out with this nice young chap that they didn't really feel was appropriate for her. So Dr. Bob said, "Why don't you spend some time with Ernie," who was like 12 years older than she was. She was, you know, just a teenager. This guy Ernie, who was this devil-may-care young chap, that's a nice way of putting it, he was a bum. "And why don't you spend some time with this Ernie guy?" And sure enough, she spent some time with Ernie. She ended up marrying him, and he just ruined their life. You read her autobiography, and it's just filled with bitterness toward this guy. And toward her father for even pushing him in her way.
Even though he wasn't drinking?
Oh, he picked back up. He relapsed very, very quickly. And then he was drunk for the next 20 years of their marriage. His parents were bringing him to meetings and saying, "You're going to meetings." And so that was another case of being there for the wrong reasons. they learned right away that your parents dragging you into the meeting does not willingness make. Anyway, they were deeply religious people, much shocked by their son's refusal to have anything to do with the church. He suffered horribly from his sprees, but it seemed as if nothing could be done for him. He consented, however, to go to the hospital where he occupied the very room recently vacated by the lawyer. Oh, just some good news about that, about Sue and Ernie. She finally threw the bum out and married the guy that she was seeing back in high school. And today, they're happy as hell. They're like in their 80s or something. Anyway, he had three visitors. After a bit, he said, "The way you fellas put this spiritual stuff makes sense. I'm ready to do business. I guess the old folks were right after all." So one more was added to the fellowship. All this time, our friend of the hotel lobby incident remained in that town, Bill Wilson. He was there 3 months. He now returned home, leaving behind his first acquaintance, the lawyer and the devil-may-care chap. He just left his wife alone in New York City for 3 months working at the department store. I swear. But thank God he did, you know. These men had found something brand new in life. Though they knew they must help other alcoholics if they would remain sober, that motive became secondary. It was transcended by the happiness they found in giving themselves for others. They shared their homes, their slender resources, and gladly devoted their spare hours to fellow sufferers. They were willing by day or night to place a new man in the hospital and visit him afterward. They grew in numbers. They experienced a few distressing failures. Every once in a while, somebody had dropped dead that these guys were treating. One of Dr. Bob's favorite remedies was sauerkraut juice. He would, like, fill you up with sauerkraut juice. And he also had, like, this knockout medication. What the heck? My memory's, like, failing me tonight. But it was, like, this super heavy-duty narcotic. And he would knock you out for, like, 3 days on this stuff. And every once in a while, somebody would just drop dead with one of their treatments. And, you know, that's how they learned what to do.
Wasn't that manslaughter?
Well, who knows? Every once in a while, yeah, they'd drop dead right in Dr. Bond's house. Well, he was a doctor, so I'm sure he could cover it up. You know. They experienced a few distressing failures. But in those cases, they made an effort to bring the man's family into a spiritual way of living, thus relieving much of the worry and suffering. Well, your husband didn't make it, but why don't you come to the meetings? A year and 6 months later, these three had succeeded with seven more. Seeing much of each other, scarce an evening passed that someone's home did not shelter a little gathering of men and women happy in their release and constantly thinking of how they might present their discovery to some newcomer. In addition to these casual get-togethers, it became customary to set apart one night a week for meetings to be attended by anyone and everyone interested in a spiritual way of life. And that became our open meeting. Aside from fellowship and sociability, the prime object was to provide a time and a place where new people might bring their problems. Outsiders became interested. Where new people can bring their problems. I always find it hard to deal with where people are 20 years sober or 10 years sober and they use AA like a garbage dump. They just come and they puke up all their frustration and despair and then walk away with a smile at every, you know, having dumped it. I'm glad that I could come in and dump my shit all over the table here, you know, spread the disease. It's certainly a place where new people can bring their problems. But if you're bringing problems to the AA meetings and you're years sober, you're not working AA. You're showing up at the fellowship, spewing your shit on the table. And there's a really big difference between being an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous and showing up at a meeting and dumping your crap. Usually the dumpers, though, take care of themselves. They usually dump their way right out of the meeting. Because if they're an alcoholic and they continue that, they usually drink or go away or whatever. Because that's not exactly a spiritual way of life. Anyway, outsiders became interested. One man and his wife placed their large home at the disposal of this strangely assorted crowd. That was T. Henry and Clarice Williams. They were Oxford groupers, and they saw what Bill and Dr. Bob were doing, and they made every effort in the world to be accommodating toward them. This couple has since become so fascinated that they have dedicated their home to the work. Many a distracted wife has visited this house to find loving and understanding companionship among women who knew her problem, to hear from the lips of their husbands what had happened to them, to be advised how her own wayward mate might be hospitalized and approached when next he stumbled. Many a man, yet dazed from his hospital experience, has stepped over the threshold of that home into freedom. They keep talking about hospitals all the time. It was their practice that anyone they worked with had to go to a hospital. Even if they didn't need to be detoxed, they put them in the hospital nonetheless. to show them that they're suffering from a disease. This is a serious medical problem you have. You need to go to the hospital. And we can show you the spiritual solution to it, but you're a very, very sick person. And that's how they handle it all. Many an alcoholic who entered there came away with an answer. He succumbed to that gay crowd inside who laughed at their own misfortunes and understood his. Impressed by those who visited him at the hospital, he capitulated entirely when later in an upper room of this house, he heard the story of some man whose experience closely tallied his own. The expressions on the faces of the women, that indefinable something in the eyes of the men, the stimulating and electric atmosphere of the place conspired to let him know that here was haven at last. The very practical approach to his problems, the absence of intolerance of any kind, the informality, the genuine democracy, the uncaring understanding with which these people had were irresistible. That's kind of the same things we have in our fellowship today. He and his wife would leave elated by the thought of what they could now do for some stricken acquaintance in his family. They knew that they had a host of new friends. It seemed they had known these strangers always. They had seen miracles, and one was to come to them. They had visioned the great reality, their loving and all-powerful Creator. Now this house will hardly accommodate its weekly visitors, for they number 60 or 80 as a rule. Alcoholics are being attracted from far and near, from surrounding towns. Families drive long distances to be present. That's back when meetings were very, very infrequent or hard to find. A community 30 miles away has 15 fellows of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that's the Cleveland group. Being a large place, we think that someday its fellowship will number in the many hundreds. Cleveland exploded. Cleveland absolutely exploded. And they had a real hard time when they ratified the traditions in 1950, because they didn't follow the traditions. They advertised and used their full names and their pictures in the paper, the whole thing. They didn't give a shit what they did as long as they got alcoholics into the rooms. And AA exploded because of them. That was the fastest growing meeting of its kind at that time. New York, very few people stayed sober in the first 4 years. Akron, a good amount stayed sober, but Cleveland, like 93% of the people that were inaugurated into that group, stayed sober. And it was because of their really, really heavy duty pressure to do the steps and to remain active, and their very, very strong sponsorship ethic and a lot of other things. It exploded. That probably more than any other area spread AA throughout the Midwest. That was Clarence Snyder's group. If you want to hear some interesting stuff, get a hold of some old Clarence Snyder tapes. They really, really are great. But life among Alcoholics Anonymous is more than attending gatherings and visiting hospitals, cleaning up old scrapes, helping to settle family differences, explaining the disinherited son to his irate parents, lending money, and securing jobs for each other when justified. These are everyday occurrences. No one is too discredited or has sunk too low to be welcomed cordially, if he means business. They threw your ass out back then if you weren't going to do the steps or weren't going to become active. There was none of this keep coming, it'll get you, you won't get it stuff. You turned your will and your life over to God in front of everybody on your knees and stuff like that. I mean, you needed to mean business. Social distinctions, petty rivalries, and jealousies, these are laughed out of countenance. Being racked in the same vessel, being restored and united under one God with hearts and minds attuned to the welfare of others, the things which matter so much to some people no longer signify much to them. How could that? Under only slightly different conditions, the same thing is taking place in many eastern cities. In one of these, a well-known hospital for the treatment of alcoholic and drug addiction. 6 years ago, one of our number was a patient there. Many of us have felt for the first time the presence and power of God within its walls. We are greatly indebted to the doctor in attendance there, for he, although it might prejudice his own work, has told us of his beliefs in ours. Every few days, this doctor suggests our approach to one of his patients. Understanding our work, he can do this with an eye to selecting those who are willing and able to recover on a spiritual basis. It's Dr. Silkworth at the town's hospital. Many of us former patients go there to help. Then, in this eastern city, there are informal meetings such as we have described to you, where you may now see scores of members. There are the same fast friendships, there's the same helpfulness to one another as you find among our Western friends. These were basically the alcoholic squads of the Oxford group. They were Oxford group meetings where the alcoholics bonded together and talked about their stuff on the side. we were summarily kind of pushed out of the Oxford group because of this, because they really weren't happy with the alcoholics. We'd bring drunks, just drunk out of their mind drunks, into the Oxford group meetings, and you know, they'd start blithering and stuff, and it was just looked down upon by a lot of people in the Oxford group, and we were kind of pushed out. And in our archives there's a letter of apology, basically, from Sam Shoemaker, who was the main Oxford group guy in New York at that time, saying, you know, we were wrong. You know, what you did is just a wonderful thing. And believe me, we've outlasted the Oxford group hands down. There's still Oxford group meetings around, but they're just minuscule compared to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a good bit of travel between East and West, and we foresee a great increase in this helpful interchange. And there's one of the lies. There's many lies in the big book. Don't ever think that this is an infallible book. A helpful interchange. It might have been a helpful interchange, but it was not a friendly interchange at that time. Akron and New York had big, big problems with each other. There was a lot of feuding going on. The Akron people hated the New York people. And they thought the New York people were trying to control AA. And the Akron people were the ones that were really successful in getting drunk sober. So they thought that they should have more. It was just a big mess. Someday we hope that every alcoholic who journeys will find a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous at his destination. To some extent, this is already true. Some of us are salesmen and go about. Little clusters of twos and threes and fives of us have sprung up in other communities through contact with our two larger centers. There was a couple of Johnny Appleseeds in early AA that went around the country as traveling salesmen, and every time they hit a town, they'd advertise in a paper or call up ministers or go to hospitals or whatever, and they would start little meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's this one story in the back of the book called Our Southern Friend. That guy's name was Fitz Mayo, the guy who wrote that story. He's been credited with starting 30 of the major Southern Alcoholics Anonymous meetings or something like that. He was really big time. Those of us who travel drop in as often as we can. This practice enables us to lend a hand, at the same time avoiding certain alluring distractions of the road about which any traveling man can inform you. I wonder what he's talking about there. Thus we grow and soak in you. Though you be but one man with this book in your hand, we believe and hope it contains all you will need to begin. So you don't need a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous to get sober, this book says. But you need to make one. In other words, you can get sober with the information in this book, but to stay sober, you have to work with other alcoholics. So you're going to need to start a group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's how this thing grew. A couple years after the publication of this book, there was a hell of a lot of meetings spread throughout America. We know what you're thinking. You're saying to yourself, I'm jittery and alone. I couldn't do that. But you can. You forget that you have just now tapped a source of power much greater than yourself. To duplicate with such backing, what we have accomplished is only a matter of willingness, patience, and labor. That's true. We know of an AA member who was living in a large community. He had lived there but a few weeks when he found that the place was probably contained more alcoholics per square mile than any city in the country. I don't know who this was, but I have a feeling that it could possibly be Geraldine Delaney's first husband. He lived in that area, Tom Delaney. I'm not sure if it is, but I know that they lived in Montclair, and Bill and Lois Wilson used to visit them on weekends a lot. I could be wrong. I don't know. This was only a few days ago with this writing. The authorities were much concerned. He got in touch with a prominent psychiatrist who had undertaken certain responsibilities for the mental health of the community. The doctor proved to be able and exceedingly anxious to adopt any workable method of handling the situation. So he inquired, what did our friend have on the ball? Our friend proceeded to tell him, and with such good effect that the doctor agreed to test among his patients and certain other alcoholics from a clinic which he attends. Arrangements were also made with the chief psychiatrist of a large public hospital to select still others from the stream of misery which flows through that institution. It's amazing how helpful the doctors were back in that time, but they were really, really interested in helping people to get well. I don't think we get as many referrals today. I think that the doctors want to try to handle the situation with their own means. And sometimes that can go counter to a productive and spiritual recovery. Some of our fellow worker will soon have friends galore. Some of them may sink and perhaps never get up. But if our experience is a criterion, more than half of those approached will become fellows of Alcoholics Anonymous. When a few men in the city have found themselves and have discovered the joy of helping others to face life again, there will be no stopping until everyone in that town has had an opportunity to recover, if he can and will. So you may say, but I will not have the benefit of contact with you who write this book. We cannot be sure. God will determine that. So you must must remember that your real reliance is always upon Him. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. They knew enough. They may have known only a little, but they knew enough. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. They're talking about cleaning up the past, steps 4 through 9, and then working the 12th step. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. That's the great fact for us. You can't transmit something you haven't got. So if you haven't had the spiritual awakening as a result of working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's going to be very, very hard for you to transmit the spiritual awakening to somebody else. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. That's step 3. Steps 4 and steps 5. Steps 8 and steps 9. Give freely of what you find, step 12, and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. I love that. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. There's a lot of great stuff that goes on in the fellowship. I truly think that you can't overemphasize how great the fellowship is. But there's an inner fellowship, and it's the fellowship of the Spirit. And it's a fellowship of people who have practiced the steps and who have had spiritual awakenings and are trudging the road to happy destiny together. And that's the fellowship, what I like to consider the fellowship of the Spirit. And I'm together today with many, many people. And believe me, it's not everybody in AA is in the fellowship of the Spirit. But I'm together today with a lot of people who are actively practicing the steps, having spiritual awakenings. And we're part of the fellowship of the Spirit, and it's just an absolute wonderful thing. It's the most wonderful thing in my life. May God bless you and keep you until then. I've kind of made it a little bit of a hobby to study what I can about Alcoholics Anonymous and the first years. Because basically AA has saved my life, I've taken an interest in it, and I've found that the more I've learned about it, the more interesting it becomes. Just a little history on Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson and their differences. One of the jokes that you hear around the rooms is, if it was all Dr. Bob, AA would still be in Akron at one church, and if it was all Bill Wilson, he would have sold franchises. And that's really what the personalities were like. Dr. Bob, you could find him year after year after year sitting in the same chair at the same meeting. He didn't get out a lot, you know what I mean? Bill Wilson, on the other hand, had one of those promoter egos. And thank God he did. I mean, he sold us to everybody. He sold us to the psychiatric community. So he sold us to the religious community. He sold us to the Rockefellers. I mean, he was running around. He was doing some serious promotion work. And that's a very good thing. One of the things that I've seen, though, through study is Dr. Bob is really the guy that worked a great program. Okay? Bill Wilson was a laurel rester. He went through the steps very early on, and it was many, many years, at least from what I can find. It was many, many years before he went through the steps again. And he suffered a period of a 16-year depression where he couldn't even get out of bed. It was so bad, okay? Dr. Bob, on the other hand, worked the steps and reworked the steps and made everybody around him work the steps. And if anyone would ever study the growth of Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll see that the Akron growth of Alcoholics Anonymous was much more substantial and long-lived than the New York growth of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can really relate that to the way, to the fervor they practiced the recovery program in the early days in Akron. Also, the statistics in Akron are 93% of the people who came into AA and really tried stayed sober for good. a lot of the people that came into New York never stayed sober. There was a horrible statistics out of New York for a long, long period of time. So that goes to show that the way Bill Wilson and the New Yorkers were practicing the program led to incredibly high relapses, and the way Dr. Bob and the Akron and Clevelandites practiced the program led to incredibly high recovery statistics. As a matter of fact, early in the book, they give us some recovery statistics, and those are not New York recovery statistics. They completely ignored the New York recovery statistics when they put those in the book. And what they put in the book is 50% of the people that came into AA stayed sober right away, 75%, 25% more stayed sober after some relapses, and 25% more showed improvement. And the only thing that I can think of how they meant improvement is that there were periods of sobriety mixed with periods of relapse for the rest of the person's life, but at least it wasn't continuous drinking. That's the only thing I can think of what they meant. However, it really pays to study Dr. Bob and what he was doing in the early days, because it led to the highest recovery rates that we've ever had. We don't have 93% recovery rate today. We don't have 9% recovery rate today. And a lot of it has to do with we're allowed to come into AA today and not work the program and not do the steps and not do service. You were not allowed to rest on your laurels back in those days. They'd run you out. They raised the bar very, very high for alcoholics in those days. And you played ball, or you were considered to not have a desire to stop drinking, and you were not asked to be a part of it. So anyway, there's certainly some wisdom in not being as aggressive as the Akronites, but I think that there's certainly some real good lessons that we can learn from them, as far as why did so many of them stay sober? I certainly want to know that. You know, what were they doing that we're not doing today? I want to know. Because I think everybody should have that information. If they truly want to stay sober, it would be nice information to have. Anyway, I'm going to start on Dr. Bob's nightmare. Co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, the birth of our society, dates from his first day of permanent sobriety, June 10th, 1935. To 1950, the year of his death, he carried the AA message to more than 5,000 alcoholic men and women, and to all those he gave his medical services without the thought of charge. He was assisted by Sister Ignatia at St. Thomas Hospital, and Sister Ignatia carried on his work after his death. Dr. Bob got sober and realized that some of the things they don't realize today is this is a spiritual malady that we have. It's not medical. It's medical, but the recovery process really has to be spiritual, because it's really a spiritual malady. We have medical symptoms. We have psychiatric symptoms. We have symptoms out the wazoo. I mean, if you're a brand new alcoholic right off the street, your first day sober, and you go to a psychiatrist, he's going to find 50 symptoms to treat you with. If you go to a doctor, he's going to find 50 symptoms to treat you for. But the fact of the matter is the underlying root cause of alcoholism is a spiritual malady. And they recognized very early on that there's a spiritual solution for it. And you know what it is about a spiritual solution? You can't charge money for it. You can't charge money to give somebody a spiritual solution. You know, who puts a price tag on God? You know what I mean? So Dr. Bob got active in his hospital, and he was able to get a wing or whatever and enlist some help. But his 12-step work, his carrying the message to the alcoholics, he never charged for. He was a proctologist, okay? He would charge for that. But I'll tell you, there wasn't a lot of people going to him having their proctor worked on, you know, because he was a well-known alcoholic. So his proctor exams kind of dropped off a little bit. And he really never had any kind of money to speak of. Alcoholics Anonymous had to pay off his mortgage so they wouldn't throw him out on the street at one period of time. He gave his life to the service of other alcoholics. And that really is a an amazing thing. I'm gonna breeze through this. I'm not gonna read everything. I was born in New England, New England village. His father was a professional man. On one page 172, I like this. It says, "Unfortunately for me, I was the only child, which perhaps engendered the selfishness which played such an important part in bringing on my alcoholism." That's a really important sentence. They certainly believe that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our troubles. Here he states that because he's selfish, that's what brought on his alcoholism. You know, there's a lot of theories today about why you're alcoholic. They're finding that we have a different gene. Of course, they say heredity does play an important part, but heredity plays an important part in selfishness too. So I think if you were to blame any one thing, or give one thing the most weight as far as why we're alcoholic, I too believe it's my selfishness that brought on my alcoholism. From childhood through high school, I was more or less forced to go to church. This gave him the resolve that as soon as he was free from parental domination, that was adios to the church. I'm going to read some things that I identify with personally. That's exactly my personal thing. I was asked to go to church until the day I joined. I joined when I was 12, and from that day on, my mother, because my father had died, said, "It's up to you now, you're a church member, do what you want to do," and I never darkened the door again for like 20 years. Down a little bit, it says, "After high school came 4 years in one of the best colleges in the country where drinking seemed to be the major extracurricular activity. Almost everyone seemed to do it. I did it more and more and had lots of fun without much grief, either physical or financial. Early on, too, I didn't pay too high a price for my drinking. Drinking was a lot of fun. But I'll tell you, we don't just end up alcoholic. A switch isn't turned and all of a sudden we're a devastating alcoholic. It creeps up on you slowly. Sometimes quicker, sometimes slower, but it creeps up on you slowly. And by the time I realized I wasn't having any fun anymore, it was way too late to try to stop drinking. I seemed able to snap back the next morning, that better than most of my fellow drinkers who were cursed with a great deal of morning after nausea. Never once in my life have I had a headache, which fact leads me to believe that I was an alcoholic almost from the start. My whole life seemed to be centered around doing what I wanted to do without regard for the rights, wishes, or privileges of anyone else, a state of mind which became more and more predominant as the years passed. That is so true for me." He graduated very high in the eyes of the drinking fraternity, but not in sight of the dean. "The next years I spent in Boston, Montreal, selling railway supplies. Then he studied medicine. There I took up the business of drinking with much greater earnestness than I'd previously shown. On account of my enormous capacity for beer, I was elected to the membership of one of the drinking sororities and soon became one of the leading spirits." That's what happened to a lot of us. We were the life of the party, you know, for a while. "Let's hang out with so-and-so. They're a blast. You know, let's go drinking with so-and-so." Many mornings, he went to classes, although fully prepared, he would turn and walk back to the fraternity house because of his jitters, not daring to enter the classroom for fear of making a scene if I was called on for recitation. When I was in high school, one of my classes I had to do a play. And the day I had to do my play, I was sick. And then I was in a class where I had to get up and do a debate in front of the class. And that day I cut school. I was scared to death to do any kind of public speaking. You'd have to get me loaded up to be able to do any public speaking. "This went from bad to worse until sophomore spring, when after a prolonged period of drinking, I made up my mind I would not complete my course. So I packed my grip and went south for a month on a large farm owned by a friend." He did a geographic. "When I got the fog out of my brain, I decided that quitting school was very foolish, that I'd better return to my work. After much argument, they allowed me to return and take my exams, which I passed credibly." Basically what it was he just barely got out of college, and it forced him into a period where he realized that his whole life was going to be completely shit. if he didn't give up drinking entirely. And he was able to give up drinking entirely for a period of time. Down at the bottom of 174, by this time I was beginning to pay very dearly physically, in the hope of relief, voluntarily incarcerated myself at least a dozen times in one of the local sanitariums. Imagine this, a doctor signing himself into the nut ward. I was between a rock and a hard place now, because if I did not drink, my stomach tortured me, and if I did, my nerves did the same thing. Finally, a doctor was sent by his father, who managed to get him back. Then the 18th Amendment was passed, which of course was prohibition, so he thought he would be safe. But he ended up hooking up with the bootlegger. Down at the bottom of 175. During the next few years, I developed two distinct phobias. One was the fear of not sleeping, and the other was the fear of running out of liquor. I always had enough liquor to get me through the drunk. From the very, very first, I understood that I had to have the booze, and I would protect it, and I would buy enough. I didn't hoard cases of vodka or anything, but when I started drinking, I made sure I had enough to get me through, more than enough. And I didn't sleep for years. I passed out. And there's a big difference. I passed out and I came to. And early in sobriety, I realized that you go to sleep and you wake up, and that's a completely different thing. Completely different. He talks about hiding liquor, which I really didn't do too much, and he smuggled a lot. Down at the bottom of page 177, for the benefit of those experimentally inclined, I should mention the so-called beer experiment. When beer first came back, I thought that I was safe. I could drink all I wanted of that. It was harmless. Nobody ever get drunk. So I filled the cellar full with the permission of his wife. Honey, beer really isn't drinking.
That's right.
That's not booze. It was not long before I was drinking at least a case and a half a day. That'll put on the pounds, I'll let you know. I was a beer alcoholic for a period of time. I ended up looking like the Michelin Man. You know, it was not pretty. Trying to control my drink, I went through a period of time where I drank schnapps only. And I got to tell you, you drink a quart and a half of schnapps every day, and it's going to get messy. You know what I mean? And I mean, that was just a grim period of time for me. I got to tell you, I put on 30 pounds of weight in about 2 months, looked like a pig, and was uncomfortable and short of breath. Then it occurred to me that after all, one was smelled up with beer. Nobody could tell what had been drunk, so I began to fortify my beer with straight alcohol. Hey, remember, he could get grain alcohol. He could get that Everclear stuff, and that'll do a number. Anybody that's ever drank that's almost a hallucinogenic. It's so powerful. Of course, the result was very bad, and that ended the beer experiment. About the time of the beer experiment, I was thrown in with a crowd of people who attracted me because of their seeming poise, health, and happiness. He's talking here about the Oxford group. His wife had started hooking up with these Oxford group Jesus people in the hopes of figuring something out to help her husband, Dr. Bob. And she started dragging him to these meetings. And just like if you're an alcoholic and somebody drags you to AA and you're not yet ready to give up drinking entirely, you're going to be interested in it. You know, it's going to interest you. And he kept coming back. He kept drinking, but he kept going to Oxford group meetings for years. They spoke with great freedom from embarrassment, which I could never do, and they seemed very much at ease on all occasions and appeared very healthy. Just like you're going to see people in Alcoholics Anonymous when you come in and you're shaken from your last drunk. More than these attributes, they seemed to be happy. I was self-conscious and ill at ease most of the time. My health was at the breaking point, and I was thoroughly miserable. I sensed that they had something I did not have from which I might readily profit. I learned that it was something of a spiritual nature, which did not appeal to me very much, but I thought it could do no harm. I gave the matter much time and study, and for the next 2.5 years, but still got tight every night nonetheless. I read everything I could find and talked to everyone who I thought knew anything about it. I have a book that's called Dr. Bob's Library. And somebody actually got a hold of all the books that were in Dr. Bob's library and wrote them down. He had the greatest books. And they were all spiritual books. But like a lot of us, has anybody in here ever read self-help books while they were drunk, trying to fix themselves? You know, like I'm okay, you're okay, while you're toking on a joint or something. You know? I mean, it's typical of us to try to find solutions to our problem without really giving up drinking, because that's just too extreme. You know, and that's what he did. My wife became deeply interested, and it was her interest that sustained mine, though I had no time sensed that it might be an answer to my liquor problem. How my wife kept her faith encouraged during all those years, I'll never know, but she did. I also have a book called Ann Smith's Oxford Group Note Workbook. And it was saved. She died actually before Dr. Bob, but it's a notebook from her Oxford Group years. And she would go into the Oxford Group meetings and she would write down really great concepts that they were talking about. This is a fascinating document. So much of Alcoholics Anonymous is in her notebook. It's staggering. It's really worth study if anybody's interested. If she had not, I know I would have been dead a long time ago. For some reason, we alcoholics seem to have the gift of picking out the world's finest women. Why they should be subjected to tortures we inflict upon them, I cannot explain. It's because we pick the women that love us almost as much as we love ourselves, you know? They think about us as much as we think about ourselves. About this time, a lady called up one Saturday afternoon saying she wanted me to come over and meet a friend. And that was Bill Wilson, who was at the Cyberling Estate, looking for another drunk to work on. And so our fellowship was started. We entered the house at exactly 5 o'clock, and it was 11:15 when we left. He swore he would only give the broker from New York 15 minutes, and he ended up staying there hours. I had a couple of shorter talks with this man afterward and stopped drinking abruptly. This dry spell lasted for about 3 weeks, then I went to Atlantic City to attend several days' meetings of the National Society, for which I was a member. I drank all the scotch they had on the train and bought several quarts on the way to the hotel. I don't think he even made it to Atlantic City. This was Sunday. I got tight that night, stayed sober Monday till after the dinner, and then proceeded to get tight again. I drank all I dared at the bar. Started drinking, and started in the morning. It says, I had to wait some time for the train. I remember nothing from then on until I woke up at a friend's house in a town near home. That's a great thing that you do during blackouts. You travel. You wake up in strange places with strange people. It's a wonderful, wonderful aspect of alcoholism. These good people notified my wife, who sent my newly made friend over to get me. Bill Wilson had moved in by this time, you know. So he had no money to go home anyway, so he decided to move in with Dr. Bob. And believe me, it wasn't Dr. Bob trying to sell something to Bill Wilson. It was Bill Wilson trying to sell something to Dr. Bob. You know, Dr. Bob wasn't going, hey, I got a deal for you, Bill. And Bill would have been covering his ass on that one. He came and got me home to bed, gave me a few drinks that night and one bottle of beer the next morning. What he did after that bottle of beer was he finished an operation and then he disappeared. What he had been unwilling to do in those 3 weeks of his early sobriety was make amends. He was not willing. The Oxford Group definitely had an amends process, and he was not willing to go make amends. After that last drunk, he said, okay, I'll do it. And he did not come home after the operation. Everybody thought he went to get drunk again. But he went up one side of the street and down the other, knocking on doors, making direct amends to the people he had harmed. And that was the last time he ever drank. The question that might naturally come to your mind is, what did the man do or say that was different from what others had done and said? It must be remembered that I had read a great deal and talked to everyone I knew or thought they knew anything about the subject of alcoholism. Here's a doctor. He can get a hold of the medical journals. I mean, he knows where to go for information on alcoholism. But this was a man who had experienced many years of the frightful drinking, who had most of the drunkard's experiences known to man, but who had been cured by the very means I had been trying to employ. That is to say, the spiritual approach. The thing is Bill Wilson took the action. Dr. Bob sat in the meetings. Okay, and that's what you see a lot of today in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see a lot of people coming in and sitting in the chairs, but you don't see them doing the step. Well, a lot of the people that come in and sit in the chairs don't make it. Some of them do, but the majority of them don't. What Bill Wilson really did, because Dr. Bob had been going to Oxford Group meetings longer than Bill Wilson, what Bill Wilson imparted to Dr. Bob was, you got to take the action. The action is what leads to the recovery. He gave me the information about the subject of alcoholism, which was undoubtedly helpful. Of far more importance was the fact that he was the first living human with whom I had ever talked who knew what he was talking about in regard to alcoholism from actual experience. You know, you can learn things two ways. There's knowledge. Knowledge can be acquired two ways. Knowledge can be acquired intellectually, and that's like we can read this big book, and we can memorize this big book, and we can have it down. We can know how to recover. So we know how to recover. But that really doesn't do us much good. Knowledge gained by experience, you can go through this book and take all the exercises and actually recover. That is amazing. That is amazing knowledge. I've learned to differentiate when people talk in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, whether they're using their experience or their intellectual knowledge. I'll give you a great example. Somebody will raise their hand in a ninth-step meeting and say something like, "Well, no, I haven't really done this step formally. Well, I'm about to pontificate for about 8 minutes, you know, and hold you all captive to my theories." Okay? That is knowledge gained intellectually, and that can even kill. I mean, that really isn't worth a shit. Then you can hear somebody say, "I just got back from making 3 really tough amends, and I want to tell you what happened." And that knowledge is really going to help you. It's really going to help you. In other words, he talked my language, he knew all the answers, and certainly not because he had picked them up in his reading. "It is a most wonderful blessing to be relieved of the terrible curse of which I was afflicted. My health is good, and I have regained my self-respect and the respect of my colleagues. My home life is ideal. My business is as good as can be expected in these uncertain times." And it really never got good. "I spend a great deal of time passing on what I have learned to others who want it and need it badly. I do it for 4 reasons. 1, sometimes, and it really never got good. I spend a great deal of time passing on what I've learned to others who want it and need it badly. I do it for 4 reasons. 1, a sense of duty. 2, it is a pleasure. 3, because in so doing, I am paying my debt to the man who took the time to pass it on to me. 4, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. Unlike most of our crowd, I did not get over my craving for liquor much during the first 2.5 years of abstinence. It was almost always with me, but at no time have I been anywhere near yielding." So really, it was a desire to stop drinking that he continued to have. "I used to get terribly upset when I saw my friends drink and knew I could not, but I schooled myself to believe that though I once had the same privilege, I had abused it so frightfully that it was withdrawn. My drinking privileges have been withdrawn. I've frightfully abused them. So it doesn't behoove me to squawk about it, for after all, nobody ever had to throw me down and pour liquor down my throat." This is a great paragraph, and it's apropos that we're going to finish up with it here tonight. "If you think you're an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride which keeps you from accepting what is in this book, I feel sorry for you. If you still think you are strong enough to beat the game alone, that is your affair. But if you really and truly want to quit drinking liquor for good and for all, and sincerely feel that you must have some help, we know that we have an answer for you." It says here, if you want to quit drinking for good and for all, it does not say anywhere in this book that we quit drinking a day at a time. Okay? That is a fellowship slogan that has infiltrated its way in. I don't say that it's a bad slogan, but it's not big book. Okay? I believe we live a day at a time. I believe we take a 24-hour period of time, a day at a time. But I've been to meetings where people use that and turn it around and say, "All I do is decide not to drink today." And it doesn't say anything about that in this book. You better want more than that. Because what happens if you change your mind tomorrow? You know what I mean? You're going to be drunk tomorrow. You need to have at least a desire to stop drinking for good and for all, or you're never ever going to make it through the steps. You're going to poop out before you get to step 4. "It never fails if you go about it with 1/2 of the zeal you have been in the habit of showing when you were getting another drink. Your heavenly Father will never let you down."